Hello, and welcome to this podcast focusing on recent advances in biomarker testing and treatment of metastatic colorectal cancer. In this episode, which includes excerpts from a recent educational symposium, Drs. John Strickler, Aparna Parikh, Kanwal Raghav, and Stacey Cohen discuss advancements in targeted therapies to treat adult metastatic colorectal cancer. This activity is provided by PER and supported by an educational grant from Pfizer Incorporated. Dr. Strickler begins this podcast by discussing the new standard of care for patients whose tumors harbor the BRAF V600E mutation.
The one thing we've known for years is that BRAF is a bad actor. It is associated with poor prognosis, resistance to chemotherapy and biologics. I think of these cancers as aggressive as, say, a metastatic pancreas cancer. They are fast growing and resistant. And so clearly this has been a very high priority for us in our field to develop strategies for this. Additionally, we had learned long ago that single agent anti-EGFR therapies are largely ineffective for patients who have these BRAF V600E mutations in their tumor. Really no significant benefit for single agent anti-EGFR over standard supportive care. So we learned very early on you have to combine this with an anti-EGFR antibody, at least for colorectal cancer. And so that was one of the early lessons we learned with this particular target. And that, of course, led to the Beacon colorectal cancer phase 3 study, which randomized patients to either standard of, this was in chemotherapy refractory BRAF V600E mutant colon cancer, randomized to a triplet regimen of a BRAF MEK anti-EGFR combo, or the BRAF inhibitor encorafenib with the anti-EGFR therapy cetuximab, or standard of care chemotherapy cetuximab. Primary endpoint here was overall survival, with response rate also a primary endpoint. And this was a positive trial in favor of encorafenib cetux over control. I have grayed out the triplet regimen of the BRAF-MEK anti-EGFR combination because if you look there, the progression-free survival is quite similar between encocetux and encobenicetux, as is overall survival is identical. So really, the winning regimen here is encorafenib and cetux, and this is for second line and later metastatic colon cancer that's BRAF V600E mutated. So that became our standard of care. Not too long ago, actually, this was about 5 years old now, this data. It was an exciting breakthrough because now we're seeing much better survivals, more tailored therapies for these patients. Additionally, this is a fairly well-tolerated regimen. This encorafenib-cetux regimen had lower rates of grade 3-4 adverse events than the control arm. Also seemed to be slightly better tolerated than the triplet regimen. Low rates of treatment discontinuation as well. So it was a winner, not just in terms of efficacy, but also tolerability. But there's an interesting story that emerged from this, and this is how we get to today, because today is a big day for targeting BRAF. And that is, when you look at circulating tumor DNA at the progression time point, each column here represents an individual patient. Look for the red on this. And you see this sea of red in the triplet and doublet, and those are clustered around acquired resistance mutations detected at the progression time point, and they're all clustering around acquired KRAS, NRAS, and MAP2K1 mutations, as well as MET amplification. We don't see that with the chemotherapy arm. It's really the chemotherapy-free regimens of encorafenib and cetux that seem to have this emergence of these resistant subclones at the progression time point. And this slide here shows the data just a different way. When you look at the acquisition of KRAS mutations, NRAS mutations, MAP2K1, you can see they're all clustering around those patients who got the chemotherapy-free regimens, the encorafenib-cetuximab regimens. The control arm, which was chemo, didn't really have them. Even though the chemotherapy-free regimens are better, it's a different pattern of resistance. And the other thing that became clear is that at that resistance time point, unlike the control arm, which was standard chemotherapy, you'll see this heterogeneity of resistance. It won't just be one alteration, it'll be multiple concurrent alterations in many patients, the majority of patients actually. So that also is a challenge. And the question is, how are we going to overcome this resistance and do better? Because although that regimen, the encorafenib Cetux regimen, is a wonderful option for our patients, well-tolerated, highly active, we know we should do much better. And I think it's that story of what resistance looks like that points to where we are today. And this is work that came out of your group at MD Anderson, Dr. Raghav, really outstanding work that asked a very basic question with mice. Does FOLFIRI work best first line or second line? Well, FOLFIRI works best first line. Does encorafenib, cetuximab, work better first line or second line? It works best first line. So that's what this mouse data showed. You want to give your therapies early. They work best at the beginning. The next interesting thing is, do you see synergies between encorafenib and cetuximab with FOLFIRI or cytotoxic chemo? And you want to look at the blue lines, which are at the bottom, which show that, yes, when you put the targeted therapies together with chemotherapy, you'll achieve the best results. So two lessons. Number one, it appears that encorafenib, cetuximab, and FOLFIRI has some additive properties, possibly even synergistic. Secondly, you want to give these therapies as early as possible. And that led to the breakwater study design, which is shown here. This is for frontline patients with BRAF V600 or demutated colon cancer. Patients were randomized 1:1:1 to standard of care chemo, which was investigator choice, or encorafenib, cetux, FOLFOX, or encorafenib and cetuximab. The encorafenib cetuximab arm was closed early. They really wanted to focus on the encorafenib cetux FOLFOX intervention. But still, it's a robust data set. The dual primary endpoints are shown here, PFS and response rate, with overall survival a key secondary endpoint. And initially, this data was reported out in, well, it was published in December, reported out in January, met its primary endpoint, response rate. Went from 40% standard of care to 60.9% in the chemo encorafenib cetuximab. And so that was statistically significant. Overall survival looked very robust here, but there weren't enough, 10 to the negative 6 wasn't enough. They needed to be 10 to the negative 7. So they couldn't report out a survival, statistically significant survival benefit at that time. And the data embargo was lifted today. And here we go. This is what the final or updated results look like. We see really just profound benefit for patients who got the encorafenib cetuximab FOLFOX combination over standard of care. Response rate 65% versus 37%. Progression-free survival also substantially improved for the encocetux FOLFOX combination over standard of care. Remember, some of those standard of care patients were getting FOLFOXIRI Bev. So they were treated very aggressively. What I find most impressive about this data, kind of stunning survival benefit, doubling of survival from 15 months up to 30 months. I never thought I would see an overall survival time of 30 months for metastatic BRAF V600E mutant colon cancer. So truly impressive. And so that is our new standard of care. So here's the progression-free survival. This is the primary endpoint. This is the Kaplan-Meier curve showing the substantial PFS advantage for encocetux FOLFOX over standard of care. And then we overlay that with, this is by Bicker, and this includes the encocetux, which actually I found very interesting. Not everybody can get FOLFOX who's sick. So encocetux looks surprisingly good against standard of care therapy. So without chemo, you can kind of get the same results as well. And then looking here at overall survival, this is the doubling of survival between standard of care and encocetux FOLFOX. So as I said, this is our new standard of care, and we can see actually numerically encocetux had a better survival than standard of care chemotherapy, with the best survival being in those patients who were randomized to encocetux FOLFOX. So looking once again at response rate, we see a 45% response rate for encocetux, 65% for encocetux FOLFOX, and the lowest response rate was in standard of care chemo. I also am impressed by the safety profile for the encocetux FOLFOX. And remember, patients are staying on encocetux FOLFOX much longer than they're staying on standard of care. So many of these side effects, adverse events, are cumulative, and despite that, this regimen holds up very well. Grade 3 or greater treatment-related adverse events are a little bit greater in the Encosutex FOLFOX, but when you overlay that these patients are on nearly twice as long, that's not surprising. And when you look at the all causality TEAEs, I think that the toxicity you really expect with the Encosutex FOLFOX regimen would be very specific to that combo, specifically rash and arthralgia, but they're typically low grade and manageable. So once again, I'm personally not scared off of giving Encosutex FOLFOX. I consider it to be a generally well-tolerated regimen. I will point out that the rash, the severity of rash with cetuximab is lower with this regimen than it would be with, say, a standard cetuximab with chemo, probably because the BRAF inhibitor mitigates the rash a little bit. I don't know if you all have a different opinion on that, but it appears to be the case that these are lower grade rashes. So once again, this is our new standard of care, and I think we're getting the message out there to everybody, and it is published in New England Journal.
Next, Dr. Raghav shares lessons learned in treating patients with HER2-positive disease.
The next lesson we learned is if you treat these patients with HER2-directed therapy, dual anti-HER2-directed therapy, it would work, but only in RAS and BRAF wild-type cases. So there are lots of drugs, and this is the key slide which emphasizes why it is important to identify these patients, because there are lots of clinical trials and avenues of creating clinical trials so that we can increase the therapeutic armamentarium against this subset. But this was the first study of trastuzumab pertuzumab, which actually laid the foundation of our understanding of how anti-HER2 therapy really works in colorectal cancer. So these are all treatment refractory metastatic colorectal cancer patients. Those were HER2 positive as per local testing. And irrespective of their RAS mutation status or any other mutation status, they were treated with dual anti-HER2 therapy, trastuzumab and pertuzumab. The primary endpoint was objective response rate, and you can see this is a very good curve for a highly treatment refractory population that doesn't have any treatment options at that time. The key lesson to be learned from my pathway is that because it was one of the only HER2 studies that allowed RAS mutant patients to participate, we learned that RAS mutations are a negative predictive biomarker for anti-HER2 therapy, just like EGFR. Because you have a RAS mutation, your signal is coming from a downstream molecule. Inhibiting a receptor tyrosine kinase like HER2 or EGFR doesn't work. Because EGFR doesn't work in RAS mutant cases, neither does HER2. So you can see that the response rates were about 40% in wild type patients, and there is this one response in a RAS mutant patient, which wasn't actually confirmed on the clinical trial. We also started learning a few other things about this. For example, PIK3CA mutations also decreased the response rates. For in mutated cases, it was 13% versus 43% when it was wild type. We also learned, just like anti-EGFR, it tends to work for some reason better in left-sided patients where the response rate was 35%, but in right-sided, dual anti-HER2 therapy had a response rate of 8%. In a correlative analysis that was done later on, they looked at HER2 gene copy numbers in the tissue, and they divided it by quartiles and percentile. And when you look at the percentile score, as you go down, your copy numbers are increasing. So the level of HER2 amplification is increasing, and can see that the response rate correspondingly increases. So the higher the level of HER2 amplification, the higher the response rate. So key lessons from this study. The next thing that we wanted to do after this study is to actually establish dual anti-HER2 therapy as the standard of care. So we looked at safety profile and the responses, and we found that dual anti-HER2 therapy is actually very well tolerated and results in robust responses and durable responses in RAS, BRAF, wild-type HER2 positive metastatic colorectal cancer. And Dr. Strickler here was responsible for this study single-handedly. It's almost never happened that pharma takes a smaller study and then makes a bigger study and takes it over. But this is what happened with this trial. It's a mountaineer study. It was the trial that established the first FDA approval for an anti-HER2 therapy in colorectal cancer. These patients were, again, refractory to treatment, not as refractory as Heracles or My Pathway study, but they had to have at least two or more than two lines of treatment. Initially, it was a single-arm study, and then it was expanded to do trastuzumab tucatinib and also a tucatinib single agent arm. So that single agent arm I want you to pay attention to, that was that single agent anti-HER2 therapy. The primary endpoint was confirmed objective response rate. Remember, this was a non-comparative randomization, so this is not a, we can't compare across the arms, but you still get some of the pictures. So you can see tucatinib and trastuzumab resulted in response rates in nearly 37% patients. The median duration of response was tremendous, and you can see that the disease control rate was nearly 71%. On the other hand, single agent tucatinib had a response rate of 3.3%. So these patients should never be treated with anti-HER2 therapy as a single agent. And you can see after a crossover, after progressing on tucatinib, if you now give patients trastuzumab and tucatinib, you don't get the same level of responses that you would get if you started upfront treatment with trastuzumab and tucatinib. So impressive waterfall plots, and then some of the translational work gave us other key lessons about this drug. One of the stories which I showed you in My Pathway was the difference between left-sided and right-sided primaries, and you can see for some reason, just like anti-EGFR, that effect stands true for this case. A left-sided HER2 responds much better than non-left-sided primaries. And then when you look at IHC3+ and IHC2+ and ISH positive, these are the two big buckets of what we call traditionally as HER2 positive. You can see that the response rate was about nearly 50% in patients who were IHC3+. It dropped down to 20% for patients who were IHC2+ and ISH positive. And this is consistent with the message that we had learned from My Pathway study, is that often in colorectal cancer, there is a very direct correlation between the level of amplification and the IHC level or the protein level. So almost all IHC3+ generally tend to have higher level of amplifications than IHC2+ and ISH positive cases. There was a final analysis which showed that the response rate stayed at 40%. The median duration of response was about 15 months. This is really remarkable for a targeted therapy in colorectal cancer, which is notorious for developing acquired resistance mechanisms. The median overall survival was nearly 2 years. And you can see those spider curves, those that respond really tend to have durable and long-term responses. More importantly, you can see that the drug and the therapy is actually very well tolerated. The orange parts are the grade threes, and it's almost barely noticeable. Diarrhea, fatigue, and hypertension being some of the key areas. One really interesting analysis that was done as a part of the study, which Dr. Strickler alluded to, was they looked at tissue IHC and ISH, that's one way of determining HER2, tissue NGS, that's another way of determining HER2, and then the blood NGS. And what they found was, you can see that when you're positive for HER2, irrespective of which methodology you use, your response rates remain actually pretty good, right? So there is still some data that blood NGS may not capture HER2 amplifications as readily as tissue. However, when it comes to actual actionability and the response from treatment, all of these modalities are sort of comparable. So whichever way you want to test early, and test all your patients with metastatic disease. So after this, we asked the question, well, once dual anti-HER2 therapy fails, can we do anything else? And this was our fifth lesson, that efficacy of dual anti-HER2 therapy, before that, we wanted to also illustrate what's the difference between this anti-EGFR, anti-HER2 therapy, and how does this relatively be affected by HER2 amplification? So this was SWOG 1613. This was a randomized comparison for trastuzumab, pertuzumab against standard of care at that time, which was anti-EGFR and irinotecan. And the bottom line is the study did not enroll to its completion. Therefore, the primary endpoint, it's underpowered for its primary endpoint. But what is very interesting in this study is when you actually look at high HER2 amplifications, anything that has a FCR or HER2 CEP ratio of greater than 5 or gene copy numbers greater than 20, the response rates went up dramatically. So nearly 50% response rate with trastuzumab, pertuzumab when you had high TP numbers. Contrary to that, all the high amplifications did not respond to anti-EGFR and vice versa. And you actually see that the entire curve and that response percentage is flipped, because when you have low level amplifications, you can still benefit from anti-EGFR and the chances of benefiting from anti-HER2 goes down significantly. So once you've gone through dual anti-HER2 therapy, the next question is what to do next, and therein comes trastuzumab deruxtecan, which is antibody drug conjugate. This is a lesson that we've learned from breast cancer, where we know that once you have progressed on HER2 therapies, which are signal affecting therapies like trastuzumab, tucatinib, trastuzumab, pertuzumab, you can still respond to T-DM1 and at that time T-DXd, right? So antibody drug conjugates do not work by inhibiting the HER2 axis. They work by using HER2 as a homing beacon to deliver a cytotoxic payload. So these are targeted cytotoxics. So anti-HER2 ADC T-DXd is an effective therapy for HER2 IHC 3 plus metastatic colorectal cancer, key area irrespective of the RAS status and also prior anti-HER2 therapy. So this was DESTINY-CRC02 study. There was a DESTINY-CRC01 study in which we had only enrolled patients with RAS wild type tumors because that had been our prior experience with HER2 therapy. But because the strategy was different, there was a hypothesis that even RAS mutant patients would respond. So this study was designed to look at two doses of trastuzumab deruxtecan, because interstitial lung disease is a key side effect of this drug, and it has been seen that with lower doses that side effect is less. So we wanted to see whether it would still maintain its efficacy while decreasing that pneumonitis or interstitial lung disease. In addition to that, about 25% patients were RAS mutant to try to see if this would work in that population. And you can see that across the board, there was a 37% response rate of the 5.4 milligram per kg arm, which is the FDA approved arm, which is the FDA approved dose for this drug in colorectal cancer. You can see that the disease control rate was about 87%. The median duration of response was 5.5. So this duration of response is not as durable as the duration of response that is seen with dual anti-HER2 therapy. This is a duration of response that is consistent with cytotoxic chemo, but overall survival did improve to 12.5 months in a highly treatment refractory population. Few lessons here is that, number one, we saw that this response occurred across left and right sided tumors, right? It also occurred in patients who had prior anti-HER2 therapy. So even if you had prior dual anti-HER2 therapy, you would still respond to the antibody drug conjugate. The response occurred majorly in patients that were HER2 IHC 3+. So you can see that the response in 3+ population is nearly 50%, whereas the response in 2+ population is about 5%. So that's the area of unmet need which we need to really work on. And in RAS wild type as well as mutant patients, there were responses. It was about 40% and 30% respectively in both those subgroups. So key takeaway is our HER2 positive colorectal cancer is rare, but it's distinct. It causes more brain metastases, more lung metastases. It's found more in RAS, BRAF wild type tumors. Because it's found more in RAS, BRAF, wild-type tumors, it's very important to understand that it can blunt your clinical benefit of anti-EGFR therapy, and this depends on how high your HER2 amplification levels are. Dual, not mono, anti-HER2 therapy, trastuzumab plus tucatinib, which is FDA-approved, or trastuzumab, pertuzumab, which is a part of the NCCN guidelines, is safe and effective in RAS wild-type, not RAS BRAF mutant HER2 positive colorectal cancer. Relative efficacy depends on how high your level of amplification is, and anti-HER2 ADCs is an effective treatment in treatment of HER2 IHC 3 plus metastatic colorectal cancer, regardless of RAS status or prior anti-HER2 therapy.
Finally, Dr. Parikh describes breakthroughs in targeting KRAS.
And look at G12C monotherapy in colorectal cancer. So 10%, much less impressive response rates with monotherapy activity. So that variation of a theme that we saw with BRAF inhibition, where monotherapy activity doesn't seem to be sufficient, continued to hold true in the KRAS G12C space as well. Again, this was highlighting the difference with BRAF that we already saw earlier. But again, BRAF, when we started looking at just giving BRAF alone, single-digit 5%, and in contrast to melanoma, where you had stark response rates of over 50%. So again, leading to Beacon and then Breakwater with, again, combination therapy really improving the response rates. So here's... I think some of the preclinical data that, again, was driving us forward to show that monotherapy activity wasn't going to be sufficient for colorectal cancer. And so similarly, we started to combine with cetuximab, and what you'll see across the preclinical data with the blue lines on the bottom, better activity with combination with a G12C-targeted therapy as well as anti-EGFR therapy. So here's what we saw, right? So we talked about the single-digit response rates, and I'll highlight that in the left in contrast to the right. So when you add anti-EGFR to each of these, again, improvement in the response rates across the board. So you can see 10 to 30%, and then with divarasib, about 30% to 63% response rate. And there's the adagrasib data. So kind of moving on, we'll just spend a little bit more time on the adagrasib data. Was one of the first data sets that came out. And this is a phase 1-2 study, pre-treated colorectal cancer patients, and all had G12C alterations and were given adagrasib with cetuximab. The primary endpoint was overall response rate, and the ORR was 46% in the combination arm. They had a monotherapy arm as well with, around a 20% response rate. And this data led to initially the breakthrough designation before the full approval. John, earlier today in the oral abstracts, presented the SOTA-PANI chemo data in post-first-line setting, but this was some of the early data with SOTO and PANI without chemotherapy in the third-line setting, and looked at a couple different dose levels of sotorasib, and again combined it with the panitumumab. And what you can see here is the PFS is at the different dose levels, so the 960 and the 240, 5.62, 3.91 versus standard of care around 2 months. And so then, where do we go from here? So I think, unfortunately with these targeted therapies, certainly we're not seeing the durability that we saw with HER2-directed therapy. And I think really impressive first-line data with Breakwater, and I think there's a movement to move these targeted therapies into the first line, but are there other things that we can do beyond just moving into the first line and potentially combining with chemotherapy to improve the anti-tumor response? And so there was some kind of evolving data, and this data actually was also seen in the BRAF setting and has led to some combination trials with BRAF and PD-1 inhibitors. But there was some data that was looking at G12C with PD-1 inhibitor to increase anti-tumor response preclinically, as you can see here. As I mentioned, this was seen in the BRAF setting with an improvement in both response but as well as durability when you look at combining the BRAF inhibitor dual RAS-RAF with PD-1 inhibitors. This is has led to the SWOG trial, which is a second-line trial comparing encorafenib and cetuximab versus encorafenib and cetuximab and PD-1. And so given some of the early data that we saw from phase 2 studies and now this phase 3 from SWOG, this led us, with our colleagues at MD Anderson, actually, to put together a phase 1-2 study of adagrasib, cetuximab, and a PD-1 inhibitor for KRAS G12C patients. Again, these are patients that could not have had prior G12C inhibitors, but have had chemotherapy and then are eligible for the triplet combination. So, in summary, I think most effective targeted therapies in colorectal cancer are blocking activation of the RAS pathway in some shape or form. Until really this moment, our ability to target activating mutations in RAS has been limited. G12C and now D in pancreatic cancer and other tumor types are providing proof of concept that KRAS is actually targetable. Really, again, emphasizing the point that dual inhibition, particularly with EGFR and colorectal cancer, is really going to be important. Many other novel classes of inhibitors, there's actually degraders also entering the clinic, and we're going to continue to see data from all of these over the next several years. So I think we'll see many sessions like we saw this afternoon for the years to come.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. For more information on this topic, click on the link in the podcast description. To earn credit for participating in this podcast, please follow the instructions on how to receive credit information in the episode description.